Hello, and welcome to the Live Book Business webinar, Bridging the Digital Revenue Gap, Semantic Strategies for Fueling Sales and Marketing. Today's live event is sponsored by Aptara. I'm Matt Steinmetz, publisher of Book Business Magazine, and I'll be introducing today's event. But before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you run into any technical difficulties, you can troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console. It's marked with a question mark. Or you can let us know. Our tech folks are standing by via the Q&A box. You can also use that Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions during the event and at the end of the hour, but you can send them in at any time. Please make sure that you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all the widgets and bells and whistles on this console. And please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on this console do and how you can customize today's experience. Now, before we get to our speaker introductions, I'd like to introduce all of you to our newly appointed Editor-in-Chief of Book Business, Dennis Wilson. Dennis has served as the Senior Editor of Book Business and our sister publication, Publishing Executive, since this past July. He has a strong background in business journalism and has contributed to his writing to Fast Company magazine, Fortune, The New York Times, among others. Dennis will be introducing our panelists for today's webinar shortly, and will be moderating our question and answer session with the audience toward the end of the event. Again, don't hesitate to submit questions throughout the presentation, and we'll be sure to get to as many of them as we can. I definitely want to thank all of you for taking the time out to attend today. We've got a great registration list and number of folks logged in today. And especially want to thank Aptara for sponsoring today's event. So at this point, I will turn things over to Dennis and enjoy the next hour.
Thanks for the introduction, Matt, and hope everybody is doing well. I'm very happy to be joining the webinar, and I'm very excited as the Editor-in-Chief of Book Business to be digging deeper into the challenges affecting the industry. It's certainly a thrilling time to be reporting on the changes that are underfoot. I'd like to take a second just to say feel free at any time to reach out to me via email or by phone to for ideas regarding coverage that we should be having, contributing writing or alerting us to news from your organizations. That's where we get our ideas. The upcoming issue of Book Business will be heavily focused on metadata, so this webinar is perfect timing for our readers. With that, I'd like to thank Aptara for sponsoring this webinar, and now let me introduce to you our speakers. Joining us today are Pavan Arora, Chief Innovation Officer at Aptara, and Hitesh Chitalia, Director, Solution Architecture at McGraw-Hill Financial. Pavan is an experienced industry advisor and incubator of new technology. He spearheads Aptara's innovation efforts by leading its product strategy and product development initiatives. Prior to Aptara, Pavan was a digital innovation consultant to McGraw-Hill, World Bank Publishing, and the Library of Congress. His drive for involvement with cutting-edge technologies has resulted in 6 startup launches since graduating from Johns Hopkins University and a 3-year stint as venture capitalist in which he helped nurture other high-tech ambitions. And Hitesh is Director of Solution Architecture for the Commodities and Commercial Markets segment of McGraw-Hill Financial. His current focus areas include content enrichment for analytics, information discovery, and improved search, supporting innovation through rapid prototyping of new technologies and capabilities, and driving technology alignment through the Corporate Enterprise Architecture Program. In recent years, he has launched a mobile application development program, supported the social media strategies, and extended the use of community tools for the C and CM business units. And so without further delay, let me turn things over to Pavan. Pavan, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dennis, and thanks for the introduction and for hosting us today, and congratulations on your new position.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank Hitesh for joining us today, particularly because I didn't know Hitesh when I was at McGraw, but he has hands-on experience doing a lot of the things that we'll be speaking about today. So in a sense, he's the brains of the operation, and I would normally say that I'm a looks, but Hitesh, I got to say the pictures up there that they have up there, we look eerily similar.
All you must have had the same pictures.
I'm sorry? Same photographer,
I think
you
had the same photographer, and maybe the same barber, I don't know. But I'm glad to
Mine's
be here.
Not very recent. So I look a lot older now. But you know, Hitesh, just as we're talking, feel free to jump in and let's make this a conversation a little bit. But let's dive right in and talk about the digital revenue gap. I don't want to really debate about whether there is or not a digital revenue gap. I know there's two valid sides to the argument. I'd just like to share some facts and spend the rest of our time discussing how to increase revenues and bridge that gap in general. Forecasters in the digital publishing world were really as valuable as they are in weather and stocks. I mean, they were generally just wrong. But I don't think we can blame them. They expected that the digitization would permeate the industry and innovation would continue at a constant pace. So let's take a look. Only 3 years ago, the Yankee Group estimated linear acceleration in the growth of ebook sales. Other forecasters claim that by now over 50% of books sold would be digital books. And the truth is, not only have we not kept a steady growth rate, but we've not grown much since 2012. If you notice here, the plateau in revenue and unit sales in ebooks over the last couple of years is really a drop in growth. So although our growth rate has declined, you know, it really declined from some significant large percentage growth over year to year down to, this is just the first quarter of the year, although all we had data for was 5% for year over year on quarter one of 2013. Although the plateau is there, the growth of ebooks between 2008 and 2012 has been exponential. I mean, from 64 million to 3 billion in spend and sales. And that is significant. And just putting on my venture capital hat for a moment, that's an exciting place to be. And I'm excited to be part of the industry because it may not be growing year over year at a linear pace. It is a larger business and it is still growing even if at a smaller pace. But why? Why the plateau? Why the slowing in the growth? And let's just take a few of the reasons why. The first is the law of big numbers. You know, as you get larger and larger, you can't grow at the same percentage rates. And we grew quite well. That's one potential reason. Another reason is we may be discovering that ebooks are well suited for some type of books like genre fiction, but not well suited for others like nonfiction or reference books. They may be suited for plane rides and less suited for lying on the couch at home. And maybe a lot of these forecasters, they applied digitization to all the books all the time. So that might be one reason, another reason why they were off. The early adopters, who tend to be the enthusiastic readers, have already made their move to ebooks. Further conversions are going to be hard to come by, particularly given the fact that 59% of American book readers say they have no interest in ebooks, according to a recent Boca report. Another potential reason, the advantages of print books have been underrated. Again, this is just another potential reason. Maybe the novelty of ebooks has faded, and the early buyers of e-readers quickly filled them with lots of books. Most of them have not read all those books. The motivation to buy more ebooks may be dissipating as a result, so novelty has been fading. The shift from e-readers to tablets is putting a damper on ebook sales, says some. With dedicated readers, pretty much the only thing you can do is buy and read books. With tablets, you have a whole lot of other options. So to put another way, on an e-reader, the e-reading app is always running. On a tablet, it necessarily isn't. Ebook prices have not fallen as many expected. There's not a big difference between an ebook price and a paperback, and it's one industry analyst suggested that Amazon is seeing a plateau in ebook sales and so is less motivated to take a loss on them for some strategic reason and is less likely to push down ebook prices. I'm not sure all these reasons, I'm sure you know they're valid to some degree, but they're missing a larger point. The fundamental reason for the revenue gap, I believe, is that forecasters believe there would not only be continued innovation, disruptive innovation, but that the industry would take full advantage of a digitization platform, digitized platform, not just as a replacement for print products and revenues, but for perhaps supplementary products and revenues. So we'll just say that again. I think the forecasters believe there just there would be more than just replacement value, that through digitization, there could have been a lot more new products. And we in the industry perhaps have stalled in innovating, but this is not necessarily a new problem. Not fulfilling the promise of digital is, or of the potential innovation, is definitely not a new problem in human existence. Actually, we've seen this sort of thing happen before, all throughout human history. If you take a look at the picture here, this was the first tank. It was essentially a tractor with cannons on it. It looks like something the A-team built in the barn where they were stuck or with all their extra, whatever else they could find. It's taken the old paradigm and using it to define the new. If you take a look at this next picture, the first motorcycle, this was the first motorcycle. It's a bicycle with training wheels and a motor, right? This is the gentleman that invented the first satellite phone, and he even said that he built it based off a cordless phone, and they were so heavy you wouldn't even want to hold them long enough to be on it for more than 5 minutes. So what the tank, the bicycle, the phone, they have in common is that eventually they actually blossomed into something far beyond their initial prototypes. So today books have been made digital, but they're merely text on a screen. The stuff that e-books are made of is just that text, and it hasn't evolved. It feels a bit young and immature. Some have said that publishers have become somewhat complacent, and they've settled for plateauing growth and e-book adoption at about 30%. I'm not sure that's true, but 30% I think is just the beginning of where we're going to go once we start to innovate further. I believe that the digital age has given us a medium through which to deliver content in different ways to build new products, and it's not just the e-book. There's disruption potential well beyond just the e-book using digitization. But within the e-book, I don't believe we put enough of the E in the e-book. We've simply replicated the book experience in the digital medium, and today enhancing it means perhaps adding a video or something. But in our supply chain, publishers are just one piece and are not in a position to necessarily innovate the entire chain. For example, publishers don't control the device. So we can't innovate the device. So we can't control the device, but we do control the content. And we also control its metadata. So is there a way to innovate such that the content can fuel sales and marketing? I would argue that the answer is yes. That the greatest value and the greatest potential innovation of e-books is not in, or digital books, is not in making them sexy for readers, but perhaps the greatest value happens behind the scenes. And I'm going to argue that semantic technologies can help us reincarnate the digital book within a paradigm that goes beyond just replicating the book experience. Arguably, the largest missed opportunity for publishers in the digital revolution is yet unrealized and can truly be mined with semantic technology. So what is semantic? Semantic is essentially a subdiscipline of linguistics that really derives meaning from content. It automates machine understanding so that content is easier to find, extract, combine, reuse, and eventually monetize. More specifically, semantic is derived from semantic tagging. And what is semantic tagging? Semantic tagging is, I'm going to just give a very simple overview here just for a moment here. And it's generally explaining what the text is. So in the first line, you see a phone number from London. And in the second line, you see the phone number with a tag around it. And the tag isn't just an XML tag that says number. It's a descriptive tag that says telephone. So now a software like Skype would know to say, okay, make that so that when it's automatically clickable, anything with telephone, to dial a phone number, right? Similarly, Google did something a few years ago that was very interesting. They allowed you to upload recipes, and if you did it in a certain methodology with semantic tagging, you would be included in the Google Recipes site, which I'm not sure exists anymore. But essentially, what they did was, this would be, the ingredients would be thinly sliced apples, 6 cups. And over here, you would make sure that you would put, before you'd put the ingredient, you'd say it's an ingredient, you'd name the ingredient apples, and then you'd have the amount, 6 cups. So therefore, the data could be mined and displayed in any way on any device. Similarly, another reason that you might have this is that orange. Orange has multiple meanings. It could be the color or it could be the fruit. And in this way, you can also have a definition behind that term, right? So let's skip ahead and not talk too much about how to implement this right now. Let's just skip ahead and start talking about the potential benefits. But before we do that, I just wanted to show you very quickly, a professor from Oxford put this together some years ago, and David Shotton in Oxford, I believe the zoology department actually, had some of his researchers semantically tag an article. And this is a medical journal article, and what he has here is he's tagged everything by whether it be a disease or an institution or even a protein in pink. And the value here is now once you have all this data, a machine would be able to understand this. A computer would be able to understand this much, much easier. And a lot of other things become possible, such as saying, hey, for every person, Mr. Computer, just link to PubMed. Or for every disease, link to WebMD and give a broader description. And it becomes a much more interactive experience for the reader. Right.
So going back to that previous slide, I can provide a real-world example of what we did at Aviation Week when Aviation Week was part of the McGraw-Hill Fold. We have a web presence, aviationweek.com, but we also have a subscriber area called AWIN. And in that, we did exactly what you're showing here, which is semantically tagging terms such as organizations as well as programs. And these were actually Aviation Week organizations, so organizations that they tracked as well as programs that they tracked. And so to provide a more enhanced end-user experience, organizations like Boeing or Lockheed, Rolls-Royce, which makes plane engines, things like that, were tagged and then linked over to their organizational data pages. So anything you want to find out about Boeing, you could click on the link that's in an article, and you would land on a page that described that particular organization. We also did that for programs, where we actually created a new section of the subscription site, which actually turned out to be pretty successful. If they wanted to, if an article mentioned a program like the F-22 fighter jet program, that would be hyperlinked, and you can click on that, and it would take you over to the program page, which then gave you a brief description of what the program was, and then you could navigate around to find all the suppliers for that program, all the organizations around that program, even photos for that program. And so in essence, what it turned into were little microsites for each of the programs. And that was actually turned out to be pretty successful for the website. And again, this is behind a subscription wall, so as a typical end user, you won't be able to see it on aviationweek.com, but it's a feature enhancement for subscribers. And then the last benefit, and I think you briefly glossed over it, but I think it's really important, is that it helps search. So if an article mentioned Boeing in it, because the article's about Boeing, the title's about Boeing, but it could actually mention things about landing gears within the article. And so you might find that the article not only talks about Boeing the company, but in particular the topic area is landing gears. and you can actually link to other related content about landing gears that can show up on a widget on the screen for related articles. Now, it might not be that obvious, but you could even then score some of these articles through some scoring and rank them according to those scores and how relevant they are. So those are some real examples that we did for that first screen that you showed.
No, that's great. Thanks. Real-world examples always bring this home. So I'm going to go further and talk just a little bit about the search benefit, semantic search. And just for a moment, I looked at IDC research, and a typical information worker spends 8.8 hours per week searching for information. And more than 40% of the time is spent on unsuccessful searches, meaning that our search engines aren't particularly effective. They could be much more effective. The time and cost associated with the information search task, compounded by the continuing growth of available content, point to a lot of latent time, just employee time, that could be realized by making the search quicker and more effective. And semantic can help us with this. Semantic extraction actually has the unique ability to disambiguate and normalize terms. So it means identifying the concepts they refer back to and enabling the retrieval of a more precise set of results. So let's just take a moment and go through this. In disambiguation, let's take it back to the orange example. We could refer to the color, the fruit orange, the telecom company orange, or even the county in California. So the capacity to identify the nature of the object mentioned in the text by effectively categorizing them enhances the precision of the search results. So I'm searching on, say, search for number of employees in orange. It doesn't necessarily search for the orange, the fruit, but orange, the company. And normalization, on the other hand, maps terms to a single concept. So synonyms will be referenced back to the same concept. For example, if you do a search for hair of the dog, it will give me hangover cures, thanks to semantics, rather than just results on dog hair. And this really enables document retrieval by idea and concept and boosts relevance and potential conversion. Even Google's applied some of this, if you want to take on the right side there. And if you search for wind and solar energy, you can get results, if you look at the bottom of that that image, on renewable energy, and you can see it's bold. So Google itself tied wind and solar to renewable, and that becomes quite powerful.
Hi, Bevan. I just wanted to interrupt for just 1 second. I have a couple questions about whether this semantic metadata is specifically related to, say, HTML5 or CSS, or just broadly speaking.
Well, that's a really good question, because in the example I just gave you, it's probably more related to HTML5, but the answer and the value comes from a broader implementation, so that it doesn't have to be the content itself, the raw content itself should be tagged, so that it could be distributed not just in HTML5, but in EPUB 3 or EPUB 2 for that matter, and it should be read as such. So you don't want to – it's a tougher question, because a lot of the systems today are moving closer and closer to HTML5 and in sort of looking for that eventual day when HTML5 and ebooks that a lot of futurists talk about will converge. Today I would invest in doing it and affecting just the raw data, the raw content, and tagging that appropriately, rather than doing it just within the HTML paradigm for web results, because you might miss out on some of the other displays that are available.
Okay, thank you.
So thanks for the question. Let's move on to related content. Hitesh, before I go into related content, I think that your Aviation Weekly example was pretty good. Was there anything – did you guys have any – results with related content, or play around with that at all?
Definitely, yeah. So one of our other products at Platt uses semantics to disambiguate certain commodities like nickel from the dollar amount or the coin versus the metal. There's also concepts like pricing locations, and one of those pricing locations happens to be named Florida. So how do you disambiguate the state of Florida from the actual pricing location, which I think prices natural gas, but you can't quote me on that. The idea was that what you do is you take the context around the word that was tagged to actually apply the final tag to it. So if in the article things around natural gas, taking that example, was mentioned in the article, then if Florida is mentioned somewhere near that natural gas word or phrase, then it's very likely that that Florida is the pricing location and not the state. And as a result, you can show related content that is related to those pricing locations. You can show the prices of natural gas. You can show the weather around the pricing location. So you start to show a lot more richer bits of information for the end user and the end customer that is all related and tied together into that one article. And then, of course, you can show other articles as well. So I think, you know, right now we're talking just articles and books and whatnot, but, you know, there's a whole world of data that's out there that you can also relate to, not only just the other articles within your corpus, but you can actually go out and link to other corpuses as well. So that's another example that we've had where we've disambiguated and applied semantics to disambiguate terms, like you mentioned.
Yeah, so the disambiguation helps for related content because we then can recommend more relevant content to the reader.
Correct.
And so, for example, I mean, that is only possible once we attain a certain level of context and perspective. Context coming from structured knowledge or perhaps a taxonomy or dictionary of related terms that are around that particular term. And perspective is a little bit more interesting. One example of perspective is sentiment analysis, actually. Sentiment analysis uses semantic tags to decipher positive or negative connotations. And here's an example of why it's needed. I was reading a blog not too long ago that claimed that Vladimir Putin is a psychopath. And it talked about his upbringing and other sociological factors. Well, next to this page was an ad for Putin's autobiography. And my guess is that the reader is likely less interested in reading Putin's own propaganda and autobiography rather than more about his upbringing or other perhaps negatively connotated books about him or articles about him. So it was an ad that was attempting to be related content, but it wasn't because it didn't take the perspective into account. So sentiment analysis would have picked up that psychopath is a generally negative word, and with that would have recommended a book or an article that the reader was more likely to buy. Related content is also seen often on the web using taxonomies through semantic, and you'll see that sometimes in more like this links, and you'll click on those and from an article page or a landing page, and get other articles that are related to the content in that particular article. So these strategies are already being used and are key to driving revenue by illuminating connections between content and people and programs of the organization. And people will spend more time potentially reading if there's other links that are and you know, reading and the amount of time that you spend reading is what publishers and authors should really be concerned about, because the competition isn't e-books versus traditional books. The real competition is the amount of time people will devote to reading as opposed to the overabundance of other entertainment options that are out there. The related content, I think, is quite important. The last point here is filtering. And filtering is also important in that sometimes you don't want to relate two pieces of content. So this is particularly common in advertising, when you don't want a competitor's brand advertised on one of your own press releases. So it's important to relate, but it works best with some filtering. And then the next benefit we're going to talk about, and arguably the largest missed opportunity for publishers, is in predictive analytics. And predictive analytics uses algorithms to guess what a customer's reaction or next action would be. The value of predictive analytics has already been proven in other industries. In e-commerce, for example, the Harvard Business Review said, you know, it's more than 10% in many cases, the increase in sales for those that have employed predictive analytics. So, for example, if I know from your IP address that you are from London, and I can check the weather automatically, the website can do this, and the software can do this and check that it's raining, and I see that you're shopping for ruby red boots, a predictive model would say, feed that person a ruby red raincoat. So using external data and information on your own catalog, it can recommend and get higher conversion. Predictive also is quite big in insurance in that it determines premiums. The data set is demographic data of the client. The algorithm assigns life expectancy, and the goal is to tie risk to premiums. So, for example, a 30-year-old fighter pilot should have higher life insurance premiums than a 40-year-old physician with no family history of disease. So predictive analytics has been very, very big in the insurance area and the e-commerce area. And finally, another example is sports. For any of you have seen Moneyball, you know, tying a baseball player's potential success to his salary and putting together a team based off of player statistics ensures the lowest price per win. So this has been very effective, but it's time for book publishers to profit from predictive analytics as well. So in the publishing arena, though, it's a bit trickier because unlike these other cases, our data sets are not numbers. Our data sets are words. So we need a method of translating words into numbers, and semantic tagging and analysis can help us with that. The potential of predictive semantics grows exponentially when we add external data sources, like I mentioned, like weather and other information, but particularly audience data. Significantly, this could help further predictive value. So, for example, if I knew that the reader was 23 years old, away from home, based off location, and had limited income, then semantic analysis could identify that books that are travel guides suited for younger travelers on a budget would be a good book to send to him. But Hitesh, I know you had an example of predictive from your experience in determining perhaps demand for, was it, I feel like it was, there was something about demand for customer demand based off of what people were reading?
I don't recall what that was, but I think I know what you were talking about, which is the example that I was thinking about. This was a case, and this is a proof of concept that we actually did with our semantics tool. So the editor at Aviation Week, one of the editors at Aviation Week that's based out in Washington, D.C., and had an interesting question. He wanted to know why certain articles that they were writing on the same topic. So we have two sets of articles about the same topic. It's the F-22 program. And some articles were highly tracked or were tracking high on with their web analytics tool. So a lot of people were reading these articles. Another set of articles on the same topic, the F-22 program, were not being read. They were actually at the bottom of the web analytics investigation. So you had these sets of articles that were very well consumed, and then another set of articles that were not very well consumed, but they were both about the same topic. So what gives here, right? I mean, the question was, what's going on and what's in these articles that we're not seeing? So we did some analysis. We ran it through the semantic engine using the Aviation Week taxonomy, and then also some built-in taxonomies that comes with our product that we use. And basically what we did was we tried to find the relationships that were in each of those articles. And we found the relationships in the good articles, and we found the relationships in the bad articles, so the ones that weren't highly tracked. And it turns out that the people were reading the F-22 articles when the program was mentioned in conjunction with China's equivalent program. So what the readers were really interested in was what was China doing about this, this program versus the program itself. And that, set off a light bulb on the editor's mind was, hey, wait a second. If we write just about the program, but not within the context of a competitor set or in this case particular, the F-22 program in conjunction with China and the Chinese program, these articles are just not going to go anywhere. And so that two things happened from that was, one, the editors now know what to focus on, and as we know in the editorial landscape, you only have so much bandwidth to write about certain things, and so you want to write about things that are going to be highly tracked, which in turn increases your ad revenue because you get more ads and more eyeballs on those ads that are displayed on those articles. So the articles themselves become valuable, but they can write more about those topic areas. So it was an interesting discovery, and that's one of those POCs that really was never done, at least in my knowledge at McGraw-Hill, where we use such a tool to determine the focus areas that we should be writing about. So there's an interesting use of semantics there. And I think one area where semantics really helps, and we've been talking about outward-facing capabilities, but there's also an inward-facing capability where you can use semantics to do the information discovery within your own organization, to find the relationships between the things that you're writing about based on how users are reading the topics that you're writing about.
I think that's extremely powerful, and it doesn't apply just for web-based websites, but with articles, but it applies to journals or to books based off of sales data. If we had enough data, we could predict or infer demand, audience demand, which does more than just empower a very accurate recommendation engine, but it tells us where we should be concentrating our authoring efforts, right, and multiplies conversion rates, which turns into revenue.
Kevin, I think I have an audience question that relates to that, and that is, if you have already all this content, all these items that aren't yet tagged, is things like sentiment analysis require human determination, or is there software that will kind of auto-analyze that to determine what the tagging should be?
That's a really good question, and it's skipping ahead, but let me just get to it right now, because I get excited about this kind of thing. In the end of the day, I'm a geek, and I get excited when I talk about this stuff. There is quite a few sentiment analysis software out there. Some of them are expensive, some of them are not. It really depends on the kind of content that you have. When I was a venture capitalist, I invested in a company that did stock sentiment analysis off of Twitter feeds. So, and we found there was a correlation with the number of people. If there were a lot of people saying positive things about a stock, it was generally going to go down. And it was very interesting that correlation existed, and a fund in London started trading on this data. So sentiment analysis exists for not just for social media, but for articles and for books, and they have that software, so it's all automated. You don't have to do the semantic tagging yourself. It does a lot of it for you.
I'll chime in here as well, since we also, J.D. Power is also part of McGraw-Hill, and we've been doing some work on sentiment analysis with them. J.D. Power collects a ton of survey data when they do all their analysis. They are starting to use use the sentiment analysis, and they have been using it for quite some time, to find whether a statement that a user submits in the survey in the freeform text area, whether it was a positive statement or a negative statement. So you can get a lot done through automation, through these tools, but they're not 100%. It does require analyst to flip through and make sure that there's some level of precision, repeatability, and accuracy. But then you'll only get roughly, sentiments is a tough topic, and you just really at first pass through, you're probably only going to get about 60-70% accuracy in terms of yes, it was a positive sentiment, or no, it was not a negative, or no, it was a negative sentiment. I think the perfect example that we always give when it comes to semantics analysis is and opinion mining and things like that is really the statement, I love to hate Apple. Is that a positive or negative statement? And to a machine, that's really difficult to figure out. And so it does require a little bit of human intervention to actually feed back into the system to say a statement like that is a negative statement or partially negative, right? It's 0.5 on a scale of 0 to 1, just give an example.
No, that's true. I mean, it takes a lot of learning, but they get better with time based off of your content and writing style and the like. So it's a learned software. Machine learning needs to be take place. But you know what's interesting, Hitesh, that I was reading something very recently that said they did a study on some sentiment analysis using humans, and they only 80% agreed themselves.
So
anything that gets to 80% even is quite good and better than nothing.
So in the market, the general consensus is the machines probably get about 80% accuracy. I think I read someplace in I think Stanford in their labs, they got up to 85%, and that was a big leap. So just a 5% increase is a huge leap in this arena. So it machines can get you there, but it does require a human feedback loop to improve the system.
Agreed. If everybody just has a moment, I'd love to get a question in here and see if you could just take a moment to answer whether or not you're investing in search engine optimization, anything to raise your ranks of your online retail titles. That could be pages, links on Google to your pages on your own website, to Amazon website. Amazon's website, Barnes Noble's website, to just anything that's any place that's selling your publication. Is there anything that you're doing? And if not, do you believe it's valuable, or would you think it would increase sales? So, we'll just wait another 10 seconds and let's see, 57%. Well, everybody seems like it would be valuable, but 57% are doing it, which is great news. My follow-up question would be, are you doing it on a regular basis? Because suppose you're a company or a publisher with 10,000 titles. How do you keep all 10,000 titles up to date? Well, that's something... it's a discoverability question. It's something that that semantic can help with. There are a number of ways that semantic can help with discoverability. But I'm just going to talk about one thing that we at Uptara, that I'm investing in my division in, and that's a solution that we are, or still, this is not a pitch, this is just something that we're working on, and it's a prototyping currently. And, we're finding there are more books than ever have been published. Last year, I think it was somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million new titles that were published, and a lot of self-publishing. And there are many ways in which enriching content enhances discoverability. So here I'll just offer one sample solution that we're working on right now. If the goal is to maximize discoverability on Google and Amazon through search engine optimization, we can do so by leveraging semantic and ensuring that the book is a relevant search result, and thereby more likely to get a click-through. So we're investing in developing a tool that will suggest keywords for each title to concentrate on their meta tags and descriptions and even their potential social media campaigns. So we'd scrape all the content, extract it, throw it through our engine, and generate meta tags on a real-time, regular basis, if you will, dynamically. And it takes into account a number of other extraneous data, third-party data, including, hey, what are people searching on today? So the idea here is to create awareness in the classic marketing funnel that will eventually lead to conversion in dollars. So I can't know that your book on Hillary Clinton has a chapter in Benghazi unless it's among the keywords already. But some you may have put not Benghazi but Libya, and semantic will help determine that, whether there's any relation whatsoever. Or Benghazi has a couple of different spellings that people have used, not just in the U.S. but in the U.K. And having those different spellings and what have you enhances search engine optimization simply by making sure that those keywords and those that are relevant today are in the descriptions. So that is some, that is one way in which semantic can help discoverability among other ways. There are a lot of other ways that a lot of other benefits to semantic for revenue, but I'm just going to quickly go through just a few more, but just in the sentence linking, which we already talked about from the David Schotten article and Hitesh spoke about. Summarization, auto-summarization is sometimes possible. There are accuracy issues, but there's enough success that a couple of startups have already sold their businesses. One of them sold, a teenager had a business that sold for $15 million, I think, to Yahoo, just doing auto-summarization using semantic technology. Reuse, I know, is not a revenue source, but as we all know, there's significant cost-saving opportunity in reuse, and if it was semantically tagged, say, I write math textbooks, and there's a, I want to pull up questions on cosine for my trigonometry textbook, it would be great if it was semantically tagged so I can just pull those up and not have to go searching for them or rewrite them myself and save hours of time. Once content is semantically tagged, though, new products are possible. And it essentially means that you can create chunks out of your content. These content chunks can dynamically be made into individual products on a number of platforms and devices. So there are potentially new revenue options available for customized content. And as a former entrepreneur and venture capitalist, I love this stuff. So please feel free to contact me if you want to talk about this some more, because this is very, very different, the type of products that you can create based off of the kind of content you have. If we take a look at the right, this is again from the David Schotten article and was done a few years ago. This is taking full advantage of what, how you can add value semantically to a footnote. It links the citation to a pop-up that gives you not only a link to the article that was cited, but also a summary of it, a preview of the abstract, and even more information on the author. It's just amazing what we can do with semantic. So again, I told you I get excited because I'm a tagging geek, but let's move on quickly, and because I know we're running out of time, to just implementation. And as with everything else, you know, there is a certain amount of planning that is required. And the planning is about it starts with just analyzing your existing content. What is the structure in which it is today, what format, and how it should be tagged, which goes back to Dennis's earlier question, so that we can make sure it's tagged for not just for HTML, but for EPUB and the like. There's different methodologies of tagging. The one I showed you was somewhat HTML-based, but there are many different ways, RDFA and others, and I'm not going to go into the geeky stuff today, but that's for another webinar. Implementing it means essentially putting together your taxonomy and ontologies and whatever vocabularies and external data sources that you'll want to use to deploy it. And deploying it means actually tagging the data. Now, this could be done yourself for sure, but it should also be done there's also automated tools. And that is, that to me is the holy grail. We don't want to do all this ourselves because it can get somewhat expensive. But it is coming. There's a lot of technologies out there that are doing this to some degree of accuracy. And we'll talk about that in a second. And then maintaining it is making sure you update the taxonomy and encouraging the machine to start learning itself. And some of these self-learning tools through A/B testing are available today. The technology.
One thing I would add, Pravin, sorry to interrupt, but
yeah.
Just on the implementation piece is to start small. Basically, what we've started out with is our own taxonomy and applying that taxonomy to tag the content and just do simple tagging. And then would basically build a search around those tags, whether it's faceted navigation on those tags or finding related content around those tags.
Yeah.
And then you start to learn from that, and you start to loop it over. I know, you know, it's hard to display it in on the screen, but at the bottom, you should probably have an arrow that goes back to the top, which is, you know, rinse and repeat type of thing. But it starts small, and it's a learning curve for everyone. And I think the best way to do it is to start off with just a whiteboarding session on how you're going to tag the content, and really how are you going to display that content, the enriched content, to the end user such that it's valuable to the end user.
Yeah, I think the strategy in large part is talking about and how much detail you're going to have. And I'm going to just mention that in the last couple of slides here. And one is, first let me just say that, you know, there are technologies out there that do both the tagging and the analysis, some of the scoring that that Hitesh mentioned earlier. The thing about this tagging, is the technology that's out there, a lot of it does the preparation for you. And some of them are better than others depending on the kind of content you have. And we at Aptara have worked with all of them. And I'll tell you that from my years' experience looking at this is that it doesn't necessarily solve the last mile problem, which is how are you going to use it, which Hitesh just was alluded to, which is don't just go into this saying you want to just semantically tag unless you know what you want to do with the semantic tagging and some of the benefits that we spoke about earlier that you want to be able to use. And that'll somewhat define the strategy that you use to tag and some of the software and that will be employed or people that you'll be employing to do this. So the next steps. Really, the first step is to do exactly what Hitesh just said, which is let's not go overboard. Start this out. The innovation is here. It's coming. It's going to be quite big, as we all have heard and know about. Make a new resolution to semantically tag 10 publications if you haven't done so already. You know, identify them for potential revenue and increased discoverability and whether or not there's a taxonomy already, so there's limited investment. Attempt to do low-level and high-level semantic tagging in terms of detail so that you can see where the potential ROI is greatest and consider the potential value and drive benefits before you go down that road. Keep up to date with the new developments because there's a lot happening in this arena. And finally, as a shout-out, a shameless plug for our host, read Booth Business. That's for you, Dennis.
Excellent. I like that.
So in conclusion, the true value of semantic is not just in extending length and discoverability. It's all of them put together, and it's to gain user attention, really. You know, television shows are rated the same way. How long do you have their eyeballs for? And semantic can take us there and can extend it particularly well. The digitization question of what to enrich remains the same, but the curation is now more advanced and can provide exponential value through semantic. Content is still king, but context is queen. As my wife says, she's the queen that gives me meaning, much like context gives content meaning. Making content king requires an investment, not just in developing more content, but in preserving and disseminating knowledge, because I truly believe if we look at it as preserving and disseminating knowledge, we enhance our current content and spend some time with that, we can derive much more revenue and further sales of the same content that we already own, rather than moving on to spending more money on manufacturing new content. This process requires an investment, and over time, as the process becomes more commoditized, increasingly popular, investments will be decreased, but it's important to start learning how semantic can help you today. So just to bring us full circle, this is my favorite forecaster. In 2006, Kevin Kelly of the New York Times said, it's not just about turning electric dots into a screen, but the real magic happens when each book is analyzed, annotated, cross-linked, clustered, and in the new world of books, every bit informs another. And every page reads all other pages. That was in 2006, so that was a pretty good forecast, and semantic can take us there. And that brings us to the end, and I know I'm running out of time, and but come and see me. I'll be at Digital Book World next week and a couple other conferences, and feel free to email me as you wish.
Great. Thank you. I think we have maybe a minute for a question. So we had a question about the common description tools that are used in semantic metadata. There's a lot of different vocabularies out there. Is that correct? And is it, how important is it to find what's right for a publisher?
Well, there's controlled vocabularies that you can create and taxonomies that you can create yourself. It's particularly helpful when you have a very esoteric topic. But often, a lot of people have done this work. So the IEEE, for example, released a phenomenal taxonomy for engineering recently. And they've done some of the semantic work around it, too. So, you know, I would do some research on whether or not your particular area requires you to spend the investment in creating your own taxonomy and controlled vocabulary, because although it does require it, there are some that are very, very large dictionaries that will not only provide that semantic information, but it'll also give you a scoring methodology to say, hey, you know, the word medicine is pretty common. The word the and and for can be ignored. But if there's a paragraph about Peutz-Jeghers syndrome, the topic of that paragraph is probably Peutz-Jeghers syndrome, so give that score a higher score. So there's software that gives you controlled vocabularies, and there's software that also has scoring along with it. So there's a lot of stuff out there that you know, depending on your topic, and you can always contact me, and I can tell you if there's controlled vocabularies around these already, and so don't make that investment necessarily without doing a search. I don't know if Dash, if you would agree, or...
Sorry, I was on mute. I think for us, in our verticals, it was just really something that we had to do ourselves, where we already had a taxonomy. We just needed to put it to use. And so it was a matter of implementing it in the system that we use. And then, you know, providing all the different variations of those entities that we want to tag, you know, correlating that F-22 and F-22 fighter jet are the same thing, right? That's where it gets a little tricky. But in the book publishing industry, you're right, there's lots of standing common taxonomies that are already out there that you can just grab and use.
Thank you. We still have some questions rolling in. I just want to let the audience know that we're not going to be able to get to them all, but Pevin will be able to follow up with you offline. Let's see if we can get maybe one more in here. As the e-book converges more with the web, how do you expect semantic metadata to evolve? Will it become more or less important as it kind of converges?
My view is that as we start to, and some publishers start to move towards HTML5 as a tagging standard or the derivations of HTML5, semantic tagging will actually be a lot more valuable. So learning and making that investment today would be very valuable. The workflow doesn't change much when you move tagging from XML to or XML-based tagging to HTML5-based tagging. The process and it stays very, very similar, and a lot of the software and tools that you use be similar or the same. So I'd make the investment or start to look at it today, but I think the benefits are exponentially larger as soon as it starts to move towards the web or web-based languages.
I see. So I am going to have to wrap things up here. We're coming to a close of the hour. So on behalf of Book Business and Aptera, I wanted to thank everybody for attending today's webinar and thank Aptera for hosting. Be sure to check out our webinar page to get more information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. If you'd like to take just a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that will appear on your screen next, so we will be very grateful. Your feedback will influence the webinars we bring to you in the future. I hope to see you all at the next Book Business webinar, and I really would like to thank Pavan and Hitesh for a great presentation here. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.